listening to the DeCesare Group Podcast. Welcome back. I'm your host, Jim DeCesare, and I'm glad you're here. You know, we are committed to bringing you in-depth conversations about business and economic development activity in South Central Kentucky, and this is our 99th episode. It's an honor to have this week's guest, retired Lieutenant General Stephen L. Basham. General Basham served more than 36 years in the United States Air Force in various leadership roles across the Department of Defense. His most recent assignment was as Deputy Commander of the United States European Command in Germany, where he directed a warfighting headquarters overseeing more than 85,000 U.S. personnel in Europe. A decorated bomber pilot with more than 3,400 flying hours in the B-1, B-2, B-52, T-38, and T-37, General Basham is recognized for his leadership, extensive operational expertise, and deep understanding of defense policy, legislative affairs, and acquisition processes. He's back in Bowling Green these days, and it's a real thrill to have him on the podcast. Here's my conversation with retired Lieutenant General Steve Basham. General Basham, welcome to the DeCesare Group Podcast.
Hey, Jim. Thank you very much.
Man, it is such an honor to have you here. And, I always say thank you for your service, and I do want to thank you for that. But I also want to thank your family for your service, too. I think that's important. But thank you for your service.
Well, look, if I could say thank you, I appreciate it. And there are so many people. And coming back to Bowling Green, so many people have actually just they said thank you for your service. Here's what I do, though. I appreciate you recognizing my wife, Angie, because that's who you're really recognizing. She and I were married before we went into the service. She was there, of course, at the end. Two daughters born, Sarah and Lauren. They live down in Nashville, Tennessee. We're so happy to be back in Bowling Green and have them close. But the friends and family here throughout Bowling Green that have just been great supporters in our career, thank you.
Yeah, well, it's such an honor to have you here. And you know, you've had an amazing career that now that you're retired and you come back to Bowling Green, did you grow up here? Are you from here?
I'm from Bowling Green. As a matter of fact, I was born up on Hospital Hill when that was still the hospital.
Okay.
My family's from Bowling Green. Actually, my family's primarily from the Richardsville area. My mom and dad moved into town.
So you're related to the Whites and the Youngs then?
I'm really the Whites, the Youngs, the Richards, the Runners, all of them.
That's amazing. So, did y'all live in Richardsville when you were born, or were you here in town?
Nope. I was, we were already in town when I was born. Mm-hmm. My family was already in town when I was born. And I grew up, I went to L.C. Curry Elementary, went to Bowling Green Junior High, went down on Center Street, and then I went to Bowling Green High. And then I stayed and went to Western Kentucky University. So, I'm deeply rooted in this community, and it was clear that when we retired, Angie as well, she was born in Louisville but came to Bowling Green, we were coming back to Bowling Green.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you're one of the L.C. Curry kids.
I am. Now, Parker Bennett Curry, I think it's called. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I'd heard someone say that you used to walk to school. Did you actually walk to school?
I did.
So you live close enough where you could walk?
Every single day. And actually, it was probably about a mile. Yeah, the entire walk
uphill in the snow,
both ways.
Yeah,
but that was the norm. That was what was great about growing up in a neighborhood where you walked to school, you walked home, you got your chores done, and then you played until the lights came on. When the lights came on, that's when it was time to go in.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you know, I'm fortunate enough to live in a neighborhood like that where we have a lot of kids that are out playing, and it warms my heart because I grew up the same way where I lived in the neighborhood. You went out, you didn't watch TV all day. You went outside and you played, you rode your bike, you had fun, you got in maybe a little trouble. But when it got dark or when you heard, "Jimmy, come home," you know, you came on home.
That's right.
So tell us a little bit about your childhood. You know, how was it?
I think I had a great childhood, of course. I had a lot of great mentors across my entire family. One of the things that I remember most about childhood was being able to spend time in the summers with my grandparents, with uncles, aunts, who instilled a work ethic. Of course, my mother and father, hardworking individuals there in their entire life. And I look back on those days, and those are formative days. For some reason, during that time, I already knew that I was going to college. I knew I was going to Western Kentucky University if I could get in. Yeah. And I look back on that and wonder what actually drove that. I can't put any one thing on it. Other than hard work, it just seemed like the next thing to do is just continue to push. And honestly, I look back on that time in my life, the time prior to high school and then into high school, as truly the foundation for, hey, you're going to go to Western. You love Bowling Green. You're going to stay here. that'll take a turn at some point in time halfway through college, but what a great experience.
So I we'll get to, you know, what inspired you to go into the military, but from the time you left to go in the military till you came back, talk about the differences you see today.
Oh, from the military that I went into to the military that I that
no,
I
no no from Bowling Green perspective.
Oh my gosh, yeah. How different is it? Well, the let me talk about the similarity.
Yeah.
Still great people, very very welcoming. You just feel like you're home. And
right.
And I thought about that the other day as I was driving around. I said, what draws me to Bowling Green? And it just feels right. I could always tell when I was in the military, if I talked to someone that was from Kentucky, Tennessee, I could guess that 99.9% of the time because you just felt right. You drive down the road and you just wave.
Yeah.
And I remember somebody asking me one time, you know them? I'm going, no, I don't know them. But you pass on a country road and you just wave to people. That's
habit.
What you do. That's right. However, Bowling Green's also grown. It's not been a stagnant city. I am amazed at how the university has grown. I love the fact that industry has grown. The number of families that are moving into this community, looking at where we're going to be in 2050, absolutely
yeah.
amazing. Great leadership throughout the government, clearly, but also people who are open to progress. Yet it still maintains just a little bit of that small town feel.
It does. You kind of get that Hallmark Channel feel at the
that's
square
nice.
Downtown. You
yeah.
know,
yeah, that's
not
right.
that I watch Hallmark movies.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that, though.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So what was your motivation to go into the military, especially the Air Force?
Well, first of all, the one thing that Western Kentucky did for me was introduce me also to a fraternity. And I know a lot of people think fraternities are just young men, young women out to party. I would tell you that I was probably headed the wrong direction in college. Joined Sigma Chi, honored to be asked to be a member of Sigma Chi. And it really changed my life because it created leadership opportunity. It also introduced me to other people out there. One person it introduced me to was my future brother-in-law. Didn't know that, but Don Gerard.
Yeah.
Don Gerard was going to pilot training in Lubbock, Texas. I had the opportunity to be able to go to his pilot training graduation in 1986, and I was about halfway through college. And the speaker at his graduation was my future wife's uncle, Angie Fleener, now Basham, Mar Gerard, now Mar Fleener back then, their uncle, Ken Fleener. He's from Bowling Green. He also grew up in Bowling Green, College High, mm-hmm. and went into the military. Fighter pilot, flying F-4s in Vietnam. He was shot down. He spent over 5 years in Hanoi Hilton.
Oh, my.
He came out of Hanoi Hilton and stayed in the military, continued to serve, became a general officer, a brigadier general, and then retired. Well, just a few years after that is when he's actually doing Donald's graduation. He's the speaker. I go there by chance. I sit at the table in awe.
It's your wife's uncle, right?
It's my wife's uncle,
yeah.
Ken Fleener, amazing individual, and his wife, Ann Fleener, two just servants of the nation. He asked me, he said, hey, let me show you something. And he took me out to the flight line, which is where the aircraft are all parked. And he said, he let me climb up on the side of a T-38, small supersonic jet trainer. He said, you think you might want to do this? I had always wanted to fly.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the Bowling Green Airport. I wanted to fly Cessnas. That was my aspiration. I didn't realize there was something so much bigger, so much faster. And in that very moment, I said, yes, I think I'd like to do this. And my thoughts of Western Kentucky, being an engineer, staying in Bowling Green, completely took a 180, and then I maybe a 90-degree turn, and I
yeah.
went completely a different direction, knowing that I can always come back here.
That's amazing. That's a great story. You know, you've spoken to our book club, and we read a book called Fluke, and it talks about that. It talks about how one little encounter with somebody, you know, just, hey, come over here and check this out, can change the whole trajectory of your life.
That's right. And it did.
It's amazing how those little moments in time make a huge difference in your career.
But Jim, I'll just add to that because it's important. I acknowledge Ken Fleener, certainly my beautiful wife, Angie, having met her, and then Don Gerard Sr., one of the founders of the Sigma Chi fraternity, also an individual that hired me at D-Trex, if anyone remembers D-Trex.
Mm-hmm.
I there are just little things that happen in your life. And I remind young men and women every single day, take the chance to explore every opportunity that's out there and never see a setback as an end. Just see it as a different path. And I can name countless individuals that kind of guided me along that path all the way back to family, to coworkers, fraternity, and then quite honestly, going into the military, so many throughout the entire career.
That's awesome. So after you graduated Western Kentucky University, you went into the military. Were you part of ROTC or anything at WKU when you were there, or did you just...
There are three ways that you can get commissioned into our military. You can go to one of the academies. You can actually do the Reserve Officer Training Corps, ROTC. I actually went to OTS. When I went to the recruiter, great man, Bill Hatfield. You know, if you remember a name from that many years ago,
they had an impact.
They had an impact. I remember when, and I chose Bill Hatfield. I mean, I chose to go OTS, although Bill Hatfield might have said, well, come on in and we'll pay for the rest of your education. But I said, no, I'll take care of that. I'd like to go to officer training school. I would like to go to pilot training. And I applied. It worked out. My wife and I both graduated in 1987. Once we were selected to, and it was a surprise that I was selected, quite honestly, because I wore glasses and I thought, well, you know, they're probably not going to accept me.
You wore glasses and you're too tall.
I tell everyone, never accept no for an answer. If you have a dream, you want to pursue that dream, just keep doing it. So, but that became the...
No's motivation a lot of times.
Yeah, those are. Actually, no is one of those things, in the right context, of course. It becomes the, not just a opportunity, but it's the challenge. I can do this. But it also opens up different doors that you didn't expect.
That's awesome. So what, Mr. Hatfield, what was his first name?
Bill Hatfield.
Was he from around here?
He was down in Nashville, Tennessee. Okay. That's where the recruiter was.
Well, so he spent, 36 years?
36 years.
That's amazing. So let's talk about your achievements. I mean, you have the Distinguished Flying Cross, three Air Medals, the Fence Distinguished Service Medal. I don't know what any of those things mean, but they sound really impressive. I've heard of the Distinguished Flying Cross, obviously, but how was it to be in these types of machines that have such an impact on our defense here in the United States and across the world, but also to be honored in such a way to get the various awards and citations?
Well, maybe the first thing I'll say is it was just an absolute honor to serve. 36 years in just a few days, and it seemed like just a few years, to be quite honest. My wife and I had a great time. We were able to enjoy many parts of the world. We've lived in South Korea. We've lived in Germany. We've lived all across the United States, a few years in Hawaii. Absolutely amazing crew.
That was terrible.
It was a terrible assignment. But you know what? If someone has to do it, I'll gladly raise my right hand. But I appreciate the opportunity to be able to fly some of our nation's greatest aircraft. And people typically ask me, well, which one did you like the most? And here's how I would answer that question, Jim. If you want to just light your hair on fire and have just an amazing flight, the B-1 is absolutely the machine you want to be in from a bomber standpoint, flying 400 feet off the ground at 0.95 Mach, hand-flying that aircraft between mountains. Absolutely, absolutely amazing. I'm so thankful to get that aircraft first out of pilot training. But if you want to revel in the just the heritage of a great nation, the B-52, which was actually the third aircraft that I flew. Mm-hmm. I flew the B-1, then the B-2, then the B-52. The heritage of a nation, I would always point out the aircraft that we had sitting on the flight line. They're 1960 models. I'd point to myself and say, I'm a 1965 model. Think of that.
Yeah.
These aircraft are all older than me. There are generations that have flown the same aircraft, the same tail number. But it's the testament to the greatness of this nation that built something back in the 50s and 60s that's still flying today. And if we do this right, it's going to fly until 2050. But if you really want to just be inspired by the technology of this nation, the B-2 is the aircraft that you want to be a part of. It's the flying wing. It's the aircraft that just flew from Missouri to Iran, back to Missouri. And you mentioned the Distinguished Flying Cross. Look, I look at the history of individuals who have been awarded, because you don't win it. You're awarded, but yeah, for just amazing courage in many cases. And so I'm humbled in the fact that I would be awarded a Distinguished Flying Cross. And it was for flying the B-2 on the very first night of Operation Allied Force, flying to what is now Serbia, and took off from Missouri to Serbia, back to Missouri, nonstop, 31-hour missions.
Wow.
But what was unique about that particular mission, it was the first time we'd ever used the B-2 in combat, okay, meaning we'd flown it on the range. We think the stealth, we know it works. We think it'll work inside the enemy's air defenses. But to be able to be on that very first time that we took this aircraft into combat, it was a surreal moment. So that's the DFC, but even more so, that's kind of the life of flying some amazing aircraft.
And that was in the early 90s, right?
1999.
So, okay, 99. So let's talk about that, because now there's a correlation between that and Bowling Green now.
That's right.
With our large Bosnian population. Have you had any conversations about that with the Bosnian community?
I have occasionally. And I'm very careful about this, because I realize there are lives at stake, yep, in missions like that. And of course, that mission was a part of NATO, mm-hmm, operations. It was also something our nation was committed to, stopping the atrocities against the Kosovarans. Even prior to that, Bosnia, Herzegovina, all the areas around the Balkan states, it was our commitment to being able to stop the atrocities that were occurring. And I've had the chance to be able to talk to just a few folks in our community. And I love the fact that Bowling Green is such a welcoming, yeah, community. It is amazing across the board. Now this is not in Bowling Green, but I was just over in Norfolk, Virginia, talking to the graduates of a joint school there, military graduates. And a lady came up to me afterwards, and she's Kosovaran. She was in Kosovo at that time. And, you know, it was touching for me, and I could tell that she was very thankful for the fact that we have a nation that was willing to support their nation. And now she's living in the United States. Yeah, so
that's awesome. Great. So, how's retirement?
It's busy.
I was going to say, you're a busy guy for a retired guy, because I know when we were trying to book this, you had some things going on. But, I mean, you've been everywhere since you've come home. I mean, you've been to our book club, obviously. That's a big deal. But you spoke at a Pinnacle Bank event. You've been on Fox News. Are you doing that gig a lot?
Well, no. That was right after the B-2s flew to Iran. They were certainly looking for someone who maybe had background on that. I know what those pilots were going through. I know what the maintainers were going through. We have to give great praise to all the individuals, not just the pilots that were a part of that mission, but Fox News asked me to be on in the, mm-hmm, in the morning as they were trying to get
through
that
news cycle. And I just happened to be watching that morning. I looked up and I was like, "Hey."
Well, it was an honor to be on, able to talk to a few other news organizations. And then, of course, the news cycle runs quick. And maybe I'll have the opportunity to do that again one day. We have been busy. I don't like to call this retirement. Let's call this transition. Look at you, all that you've done in your career, and you're still going.
It's the next chapter.
That's right. That's right. Just turn the page and keep right on writing.
Because we're still young guys.
I think I am. At least in my mind, I am. My body sometimes disagrees, but I look at you as a runner, though. You know, this is the way to stay young. Yeah. Just keep right on moving. But I think you still have something to give. Mm-hmm. And when you finish that first chapter and you move on to the next, and it's not even the first. I mean, the first chapter was being born and all the things growing up. But now this chapter that we're in now, it's still a process of giving. So I've stayed busy. I do consulting work because I really like to be able to connect the defense industrial base to the Department of Defense, because there were so many things that when I wore the uniform, I just didn't know. Now I find myself on the other side going, if I would have only known that, I could integrate those things, find a better way to peace, because that's what the military is always focused on. Yeah. You know, the Department of War focused on peace. This, mm-hmm, we would prefer not to go to war. If we have to, we're going to win. There's no doubt about it. But let's call it a transition, not a retirement.
There you go. But your days are full.
They're full. My wife would tell you that, Angie would tell you that I don't know how to say no. I'm slowly learning how, but at the same time, as I said earlier, see every door that you step through as an opportunity. And if you just slow down a little bit to realize 5 minutes is actually a long time. Mm-hmm. You can do an awful lot in 5 minutes.
Absolutely.
Step through the door. If it's right for you, keep doing it. If it's not right for you, go on, do something else. You've experienced something new.
That's right. You know, you've had a lot of recognition for your leadership, legislative affairs, and understanding defense policy. And we actually, before we started recording, we were talking about the legislative process, how you have to be in it to some extent to understand it. If you're just, you know, Joe Citizen and you're picking up bits and pieces, sometimes it can be frustrating.
It can be.
It can be very frustrating, actually, because you just, you know, why is it not being done this way? Sometimes people think that common sense does not prevail in Washington or in Frankfurt or any other state capital. But, you know, having that experience, how do you plan to use that expertise in the future? I mean, you're going to run for office maybe someday, or do you have any aspirations for anything like that?
Well, the how do I we'll answer the last question first.
Okay.
You know, if the right opportunity, the right environment, the right support were there, then I think we would consider it. And I say we because it would always be my wife and my family. You don't do any. I didn't get to where I was in the military by myself, clearly. I always say, when it comes to my marriage, I scored, my wife settled. But in the end, we were a team getting there. So in the right environment with the right support, that could be an option for us. Here's what I really, and I was so fortunate to be the Air Force's legislative liaison 1 year as a colonel, and my office was in the house in the Rayburn building over on the House of Representatives side.
How convenient.
Well, it was a good place to have an office because you could do your job. But I also, it gave me the access to be able to understand exactly what's going on. And then for three years, I was the director of legislative liaison as a two-star general. So it was my job to be able to be the liaison between Congress and United States Air Force, and in many ways, the Department of Defense. I spent more time, quite honestly, trying to help the United States Air Force to understand Congress rather than Congress to understand the Air Force's desires or budget. And the reason I did that is because once you actually understand the process that's taking place, and you understand the representatives and the senators, they're coming from all around the United States, then it starts to actually make more sense to you. And if you operate with inside that process rather than always fighting against the process, I'm not going to say it won't be frustrating. There will be times it'll be frustrating, but at least you'll be able to sleep a little bit better at night knowing that there's still opportunity. Sometimes you just have to be patient in how you work through that. So for me, I use that every single day, Jim. Now I take the experience that I had. It's the same experience I had when I was in Korea working with the Republic of Korea, my counterparts, working in Germany, working with NATO counterparts, working with European counterparts. You have to actually see it from their point of view, not just your point of view. So that time in Congress kind of prepped me for the next phase of the military career, but even more so now. It opened up doors, and it actually opened my eyes to a process that maybe I just didn't understand.
Yeah, it's awesome. And it's neat to have all those different experiences as well, because, you know, I think we all evolve over time, and we're always learning. At least you should be. I think everybody should be always learning something. And even at this stage of life, we can learn something and use it apply it to our everyday profession or whatever we do in life.
That's
and
right.
And taking those experiences, you know, working in Congress, that's a cool gig, especially when you can work there and you don't have to be elected.
Well, you know, let me throw a shout out to the real members are there. They're the elected mm-hmm. ones. They're the ones that have to make the vote. And they have to own the vote.
But and they have to vote their constituency
that's
as
right.
well.
That's right. This is it. There are very few votes that actually surprise anyone if you actually understand mm-hmm. The constituency. But we should also thank the staffers that are working the Hill across the board. Those the committee staffers, the personal office staffers, those that are actually here in the you know, I think of a good friend of mine, Mark Lord. Just a great friend. And what he's doing for Congressman Guthrie, amazing.
Yep.
We need to thank them as well, because they're the individuals that are lining things up to make sure that the members can make the vote.
Yeah, because it's a tough job when you have that many constituents. You can't just – and I think a lot of people don't understand. I mean, even at the local level, if you're a mayor of a small town, or if you're a magistrate or a city commissioner, it's your stat. You know, you're elected. You're there to be their voice.
Right.
In that process, but the day-to-day activity and understanding every nuance of how government works, you got to have good people around you to help fulfill those needs.
That's exactly right. As a matter of fact, I look at what Mayor Alcott does. I look at what Judge Gorman does, and I'm always amazed. And of course, they look like the great teamwork there. But you have to have a phenomenal staff, and that's in every single organization out here. Every single company out there, I guarantee every CEO, every president of an organization, they really do appreciate the fact that they've got people that can align their processes, but even more so align them to the day-to-day activities that have to take place.
Yeah, I'd love to maybe get you on again in the future and talk about leadership, because, you know, the one thing about leadership is culture always wins.
Yeah.
And if you have a leader that inspires a good culture and brings good people to be around them, then you're going to have success.
Well, I'd love to do that sometime, because I am a believer in organizational culture. And if you don't understand your organizational culture, then you're never going to be able to change it. And it'll follow yours. It'll, you know, your true beliefs, your norms, your values will come out. Those things which you display. Absolutely amazing opportunities there.
All right, let's have a little fun now.
All right.
Before we wrap things up. So, You've 3,600 hours in an aircraft. Some of the most memorable experiences that you could share.
Well, most memorable. I think if we start with the early days, when you go through pilot training, it's 1 year of training. So I went to officer training school, and then you go into pilot training. I was in pilot training in Del Rio, Texas, right on the Rio Grande, U.S.-Mexico border. And the first aircraft you fly is a T-37, mm-hmm. side-by-side seating. And this aircraft is designed to teach you just the fundamentals of flight, but it's also designed to teach you the fundamentals of how to get out of a really bad situation. And one of the things that they do with that aircraft, or we do with that aircraft, is we no longer fly it, but we would put it into a spin. And you put it into an actual spin so that you can train yourself to come out of a spin. It's not like some aircraft, if you just let go of the controls, it'll come out of the spin on its own. This one, you have to actively do certain things inside the aircraft. Well, the short story of this most memorable and probably most memorable scare in an aircraft is I was setting myself up. First time I've gone to the local training area, flying by myself. The instructor's not there. I'm going to do a loop in this aircraft. I start the loop all wrong. I start too slow. I start to pull up. Now I'm too slow over the top. And as I'm sitting there upside down in the aircraft, I realized I'm about to fall out of the sky because I don't have enough flying speed. The aircraft almost goes into a full spin. I remember I'm just slamming the controls around, probably not following the procedures that I was trained to do.
Right.
In the end, I come out of this spin-like event, flying toward the ground. I pull up, everything grays out on me. I level the aircraft off. I've got people who are watching me on the radar. They know something's going on. They're telling me to change my direction. I'm about to fly into Mexico. And I remember this event so well, because at that moment, when I got the aircraft back together, I went to the top of the area, so a little higher altitude, and I had a decision to make. Either I'm going to take that aircraft back to the runway, land, and never fly again, or I'm going to analyze what I did wrong, and I'm going to turn around and do that loop the right way. I chose to do the loop the right way.
Yeah.
And from that point on, it was I won't say smooth sailing, but it set me on that trajectory of, okay, you can do this. You just got to got to do it right. I'll tell you probably the most memorable thing about the B-2. So, you know, we talked about flying this, the mission for the Distinguished Flying Cross. That's a 31-hour mission. We took off from Missouri. We flew over to what was then the former Republic of Yugoslavia, Serbia. And
do you go across or over?
You actually fly, in this particular case, because you don't want to be seen, uh-huh. you fly a route that you're not going to be seen by airliners, so
gotcha.
You're probably not going to fly the shortest route. You're going to have to do refueling a couple of times, and because we don't want people to know that B-2s are headed to Europe, you want to stay as far from land masses as you possibly can.
Gotcha.
You're probably going to fly through the Straits of Gibraltar and then through the Med, and you'll do a few refuelings along the way. So refueling is when you fly up behind a refueling aircraft, a KC-135 or back then a KC-10, they plug the boom nozzle into your aircraft, and for the next 30 minutes, you're going to be flying close formation with that aircraft as
wow.
they're transferring fuel. And you're going to do that four times. I will tell you, Jim, it's a lot easier that first refueling, but after you've been awake for about now 30 hours, that last refueling became pretty tough. And it's
yeah.
typically in the dark as well, which is always tough. But probably the most memorable part of that mission was, first of all, certainly being able to do what our nation asked us to do, what NATO was asking us to do, and to save people by stopping the atrocities against Kosovarians by taking out certain targets. But here's the most memorable. When we flew that aircraft back, so no one really knows that we're flying, and as we came back into the air traffic for the United States off the eastern coast,
mm-hmm.
and there was a controller that came on who knew who we were and knew what we had just done because it hadn't been published yet.
Yeah.
He came on and we checked in and our call sign, Dark. And he came on and said, Dark, checking in at flight level 260. And then he said something that has always stayed with me. He said, welcome home.
Yeah.
That was the moment that I realized what a great nation we have. I was so thankful to be able to serve the nation flying, serve the nation leading, serve the nation in so many staff assignments throughout the world. But that's the one that sticks with me all the time. And now I'm back in Bowling Green,
yeah.
and it's the same thing. Welcome
yeah.
home.
Yeah, welcome home. I got chills when you told me that because I can only imagine what it's like after doing something so historic, which it truly was. And a flight controller having the knowledge of what's going on, but not making a big deal of it either.
That's right.
Just keeping it very subtle. Welcome home.
That's exactly right. Well
that's
said.
Pretty cool. All right. So what did you think about the band at the Sigma Chi homecoming a few weeks ago?
Boy, I'll tell you what, they're out of control. Disorderly conduct. It was great to get so many of our fraternity brothers back. It was a calm night as we've all become a little older, a little more mature. And
well, there was a World Series game on that night too, which was it was the final game.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And I'll tell you, to see that many individuals huddled around, husbands, wives, a great evening. But to your point, the band and you know that Judge Wilson, he's an amazing individual as well, but all of you were fantastic.
Well, thank you.
Yeah,
that's what I was fishing for.
Yeah. Yeah, he's actually, and I've had the good fortune to meet and spend some time with him now that we're back in Bowling Green. And that's the other nice part. There was a group in Bowling Green that we grew up with, our family and friends, and now there's a whole new group. People like Dan Cherry.
Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely amazing individual. He is. I mean, he really is. And I appreciate the opportunity to be able to learn from him for many years to come and so many others. But that Judge Wilson, he's got some vocal cords.
He's
a keeper.
Real quick, speaking of General Cherry, very involved with Aviation Heritage Park, and you know there's so many great aircraft out there that have connections to Bowling Green. Are you involved with the organization?
I am. As a matter of fact, they were kind enough to place a couple of my uniforms in there in the exhibit. But more than anything else, we get to go out there sometimes on Saturday mornings. We call them Simulator Saturdays, and young men and women, young boys, girls come out and I get to fly with them for a few minutes. That is amazing to watch the light bulb come on. Some get it right away. Some take a little bit of time.
Yeah.
But to be able to walk not only outside in those aircraft, and there's a story to an aviator from South Central Kentucky that you would never know about it. And people drive by it all the time. And I don't know why they wouldn't stop, but don't just look at the aircraft, go inside.
Yeah.
Because that's where you're going to see the stories of the great aviators around this area. Dan Cherry being just an instrumental part. That's his F-4 sitting out there,
yeah.
A Thunderbird lead. And then Bob Budness, the director out there, executive director, has done an amazing job. So I highly recommend anyone, whether you're interested in aviation or not, if you just want to revel in the technology of this nation, go spend a little time inside the museum.
Yeah, I mean, you got Terry Wilcutt's plane out there. You got a replica.
Willa Brown.
Mac Reynolds, Marine One. I mean, just cool stuff.
Yep, that's right.
And everybody's got a connection to South Central Kentucky.
Well, Ray Nutter's there, and I'll tell you what really, here's what means an awful lot to me. Just two displays down from my display is the individual that I hold in highest esteem, retired Brigadier General Ken Fleener,
mm-hmm.
Who gave to his nation 5 years away from his family, enduring torture, isolation, things that none of us can imagine, and we don't want to imagine things like that.
Right.
And then he came out and he continued to serve his nation. I'm humbled, I'm honored that just a few displays down, I'm able to be in the same display case as him. Not certainly, I don't feel worthy of that, but at the same time, it's an amazing honor.
Well, and I can tell you, we're all grateful.
Well, so thank you.
We appreciate that. Hey, General Basham, thanks for being on the DeCesare Group podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on. I look forward to meeting folks in and around Bowling Green. If I don't know you, come up and say hello.
Thanks again to retired Lieutenant General Stephen L. Basham for joining us this week on the DeCesare Group podcast, and thank you for checking us out. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend, and don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave us a review and share your feedback with us as well. You can also follow the DeCesare Group podcast across all of our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, X, and YouTube. And you can even subscribe to our weekly newsletter, Soke Economic Development and Business News, by going to our website, thedecesaregroup.com. The DeCesare Group podcast is produced by the DeCesare Group, a public relations and consulting firm based in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Our engineer and piloting this podcast is Justin DeCesare, with content contributions from Brooke Mattingly. The DeCesare Group podcast is researched by Amy DeCesare. I'm Jim DeCesare, inviting you to join us again next time for the DeCesare Group podcast.